Welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts, Alana Ojibwe
and Demoite Wesley. We're so excited to share this second series where we speak with facilitators from a recent National Center co-sponsored event. This event on equitable systems design for restorative justice provided an opportunity for participants to engage around key themes such as procedural fairness, access bias and decision-making, cultural competency, research and evaluation, policy and advocacy, and program implementation and fidelity.
The conversations in this series of the Restorative Lens create the opportunity to share some of these insights, reflections, and continued questions that came out of this event, as well as explore opportunities to address disparities within restorative justice implementation moving forward.
Thank you again for tuning in to the Restorative Lens, and we hope you enjoy listening.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Thank you so much for making time again for having this conversation with us. We're really looking forward to talking with you on this theme of cultural competency in this larger series as a kind of flashback to the conversation a few months ago in the equitable systems design of restorative justice practices in San Francisco. So thank you again. If you could just start us off with an introduction, who you are, your name, where you're based now, and what is a recent activity that has brought you joy?
Well, thanks for that, Alana. My name is Ish Orkar. I use she, her pronouns. I'm based in New York City. And a brief introduction is just that I've done a lot of different things in my life. And some of those roles have been working as a social worker, as a lawyer, as a DEI professional. The role I would say I'm most passionate about is that of a restorative justice practitioner, which is why we're having this conversation here today. And I'm just so glad to be here. Oh, the activity, the fun activity. So something that I think brings me a lot of joy is that I am part of a community choir here in New York City. It's called the Fire Ensemble, and it's directed by Troy Anthony. And it's just one of the things that I look forward to each and every week, and it brings me so much joy. And I love singing, but I love singing in community even more. So that's something that I'm really excited to be a part of.
That is so beautiful. I'm a choir kid from way back. That's a good push to join a community choir here in Houston. Well, thank you so much for sharing that little bit about yourself. We want to dive a little bit deeper into your journey to and through the world of restorative justice. What brought you to restorative justice? And how does your experience in the RJ world intersect with this idea of cultural competency when it comes to RJ practice?
Oh, that feels like a really big question. I feel like there have been parts of my life and my story that have always been linked to restorative practices. I might not have always had the name for it or the words, but I think that throughout my personal and professional journey, I've always thought about this question of how best can we be together in community, right? Like, how do we relate well to each other? And that's really what led me to pursue a career in social work, because I was really interested in the relationship with self, with others, with systems, right? And digging into how do we really create an environment in which people can thrive? And so I've been kind of on a quest to answer that. And that's actually what led me into pursuing a degree in the law, to think, well, maybe from a systems perspective, I can work within systems and really help folks like navigate something that is often really oppressive and a really challenging time in your life to be system impacted. But then also on the social work side, I realized that I was really heavily invested in relationships. And so I've worked as a therapist, where I've provided interpersonal counseling on relationships. I've been a couples therapist in the past. And then I feel like a recent position I had, or not too long ago, was for a legal service agency. And in that role, I provided free legal services to folks who were survivors of domestic violence and sexual violence and had intersections with the family law world. So often I'd go into court, but I'd be primarily building relationships and offering support with people who were really struggling with their families of origin and their chosen families, and figuring out what does family look like in the midst of this really unexpected disruption. How do we navigate, you know, the feelings we have for someone when they, you know, engage in acts of violence against us? Like, it's so complicated, and it's not a journey that I think anyone should have to go through on their own. So I've just always been sort of passionate about, I don't know, am I rambling? I don't know. I wanted to help others figure out the best way forward. And to me, that's really what restorative justice is all about. So in my mind, there is a through line that has led me to the point where I am here today.
That's beautiful. And we should actually maybe just rename the podcast Restorative Rambling, because I think that's part of the beauty of these conversations, is just wherever it goes. And so fun to learn so many new things about you and your past professional lives that I didn't know. A person of many talents and hats. Thinking about kind of building off of that and kind of zooming into this topic in particular, just from a starting point, assuming that people may be joining from different backgrounds and levels of familiarity with what sort of cultural competency means, how it can be defined, what it looks like, what, from your view, how do you describe what it means to be culturally competent, and what is the importance of that when thinking about working in restorative practices?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if I were to define cultural competency, it's really about understanding that everyone has a culture and everyone comes from a specific, or maybe many cultures, I should say. And that really having an awareness of that allows us to reach across difference and learn to build connection with hopefully a full awareness of all of the identities present, right? So if I'm meeting someone, I'm really curious about what are their beliefs and what is their language and what is their background and really what is their story? And that approaching it with a level of curiosity allows me to get to know someone in the fullness of who they are. And that's really where we should all begin, right? We shouldn't begin from a place of a lot of assumptions or biases, or from our own perspectives, from the way we were raised or from the way we've been socialized. And so it's really pausing, I think, and having an awareness of our positionality and relationship to each other, and how that fits in with restorative justice. I think ideally, we all want to live in a world where that's how folks first approach us, right? And that's such a wonderful foundation for building relationship, because I think it's incredible just meeting other restorative practitioners and folks that are in this space, how quickly we're able to form bonds and connection. And I think it's because we really approach each other as these wonderful creatures. And we just already are so excited to see the potential in each other. And starting off from that place gives us all such a huge advantage when we think about being in right relationship.
Thank you for that reflection of the connection, which to me feels like a very natural connection between having a good foundation in cultural understanding and being an RJ practitioner. But of course, we know that maybe those things aren't as natural as we think, or like not as automatic. The last season of this podcast was with authors from the Colorizing Restorative Justice book, which, you know, really came forward to say that there are maybe some gaps in our understanding when it comes to cultural competency as it relates to RJ practice. And so, like, with that in mind, how can practitioners, do you think, account for their own biases and really check those things when, like I said, maybe depending on how you were trained, that doesn't come up in your training? Or, yeah, in your experience, what does that look like as a practitioner?
Wow, that's such a great question. I think the way I'm going to answer that question is by telling you a little bit about where my session went when we met. And we started by saying, okay, we're here to talk about cultural competency, but guess what we'd rather talk about? And we raised this idea of cultural humility, right? And I don't know if you're as familiar with that definition. When I went to social work school over a decade ago, we were all talking about cultural competency, but that has changed now. And a definition that I had shared with my group is from the University of Oregon. And I can share a little bit about that if you're interested. So really how they define it is that it's a personal lifelong commitment to self-evaluation and self-critique. An individual doesn't just learn about someone else's culture, but starts with an examination of their own beliefs and cultural identities, right? And then another piece of this that I think is really important is a recognition of power dynamics and imbalances, a desire to fix those imbalances or respond to them in some way, and to develop partnerships with people and groups who advocate for others. The other thing I like about this particular definition is it talks about institutional accountability also being a really important part of cultural humility. And so I feel like when I take all of those pieces together, it answers your question of how do we do this work? And what I spent a lot of our session talking about is, do we as individuals and practitioners spend enough time on the self-reflection and self-awareness piece, right? Because I think that that is so important and that is where it starts. And it's work you have to do consistently, and it's work that's never done. And where the discussion led in our group is to this question of then how do we hold each other accountable? And to me, that's where the RJ piece comes in, right? Because it's really hard to hold yourself accountable. Maybe that's why we need to be in community with others, because we can support each other in this work in that way.
That I really, really love. One, that you sort of took it in that direction in this conversation. And I think it just is such a powerful reframing of, because I think so much of the conversation around cultural competency is almost comes across as a one-way street of in a good intentioned way of really understanding, you know, sort of on the receiving end of who are you in space with, rather than beyond an acknowledgement of a real assessment of thinking about like, who are you and showing up in that space as a part of this conversation as well. And you said that from the beginning of thinking about cultural competency in this sense of like, everyone comes from a culture, a mix of cultures, and that's informed by all kinds of things. It's informed by race, it's informed by geographics, it's informed by socioeconomics, it's informed by so many things, and those intersectional identities within that. So I really, really think that framing opens up this conversation in just a really powerful way, because it's not just sort of on the receiving end thinking about, you know, as practitioners or system actors and stakeholders, how to be culturally competent, but really in doing so, reflect of like, what are you bringing to that as well, and bringing that in. So that actually is a perfect segue to the next piece, which was thinking about kind of a zoomed out perspective. And, you know, I think a lot of conversation also tends to go in what a lack of cultural competency can look like, which is important, hugely important to understand what the impacts and just sort of manifestations of that are, but also would be helpful to hear your thoughts on what does an investment in cultural competency or cultural humility look like, and at different levels, because it shows up differently, but I think there's through lines of what keeps pieces of it that are really powerful and meaningful can be the same, whether you're talking about an organization or an institution or a jurisdiction. So in your mind, what would, if there's some tangible examples or some dream examples of what an investment in cultural humility could look like, what would it look like?
Oh, that is the question. Thank you for inviting me to think about that. I'm going to try to answer it this way and let me know if I missed the mark because I'm open to that feedback. But what comes to mind, probably surprising no one, is a community of care is really my answer. And when I think of that in terms of circle practice, although there are so many different ways in which we can be in supportive and engaging healthy community with each other. But I guess just reflecting on my own experiences, I have found the multiple ways in which sitting in circle with others can help us live out our commitment to this work. I think are reflective in the cultural humility definition that I shared, right? So if I think about it in three ways, one in self-reflection and thinking about who we are when we sit in circle and what we're bringing with us, and how that's informed by all of the things that you just named, and how that's true for all of us, right? When we pass that talking piece, we get to witness the ways in which that's true for our fellow friends and colleagues and family members as well. And so we're doing both. We're reflecting on self, but we're also spending time deep listening and in community with other. So that self-reflection and awareness piece, I think, is huge. And then secondly, this question of power. What do we do with power? What do we do with the power we show up with and the power that we leave with and the ways in which we engage and either, use power in oppressive ways or try to dismantle oppressive systems, when we leave circle? I feel like that is so critical to this work. And I don't think we spend enough time really thinking about how to enact that. And I feel like circle practice is a way in which we can take those little first steps and to begin to experience what that might be like outside of circle. And then third, in terms of accountability, I think we should hold each other accountable in circle. And I feel like it's a wonderful opportunity to do so with care, right? Because I think that's why so many people are afraid of going deeper or having real conversations is because they don't feel there's a safe space to do so. They feel like they risk losing so much by just acknowledging, I don't have the answer to that, or I might still have learning to do. I mean, it sounds awful to say, but to be able to say, yeah, I'm a flawed person and I need to grow and learn. And can you help me in that? I don't think there's a lot of spaces in which we feel like we can show up that authentically. And so that's what I think is the answer to cultural humility. It's practicing it, and it's looking for places in which we can do that. And I think circle practices is a wonderful place to start.
Yeah. Thank you so much for like highlighting risk, the risk it takes to be in relationship. The R in relationship stands for risk. The risk it takes to be in community, to hold ourselves and each other accountable. And this point about power, which in my experience, there is something about like sitting in circle that the power dynamics don't disappear, but there is a sort of flattening, right? Built into the design of the circle. And at the same time, I do think that there are times where power has to shift, right? So, like, this idea of doing this work in community, doing restorative justice work with communities that have historically been on the opposite end of power, right? Who have been marginalized, subordinated to these systems. What does it look like then to step into and be in community with these folks who have, again, been most impacted, who are closest to the inequities of the criminal legal system? How do we center them in this RJ work, and include them in the decision making? That is so important to this work.
Yes. Yes to all of that. Something that comes to mind is I mentioned the choir earlier. So when we do warm-ups, Troy leads us through this beautiful song, and it's very simple. It's one line. It says, "I remember who I am." And it's so spiritual. It's one of my favorite things to sing because I think that's what happens when you are marginalized or when you are oppressed, is that the goal is to help you forget and to create distance between who you think you are and who you actually are, right? And so the more that we can remind each other, I think, of what it means to really be whole and to really step into the power that we all were born with, I think that's a really incredible act of resistance right there. And so when we sit in circle, the fact that we can remind each other of that, I have a story. Can I share a story from my session? I love this story because it was such a surprise to me. But one of the things we did at the beginning as an exercise is I asked everyone to pick a container that they felt they were relating to in some way and explain why they chose, you know, if they could be any container in the world, why they would choose that one. And so one of our participants said that they would be a violin because they love this idea of making beautiful music for others. And I was so touched by that. And I thought, oh, that's so nice. And so later on in the conversation, you know, we got in real deep and folks are bringing things up and asking us to partner with them and some brainstorming and helping them navigate some really challenging situations. And the same person said, you know, that they were really frustrated with their current role and they felt like they didn't know what their place was and if they had purpose and how they could really have impact. And one of the things that came to mind, and I just blurted this out, I said, what if your role is to play beautiful music? And they were like, well, what do you mean by that? I was like, well, just think about like being present, like your ability to be consistent, your ability to adapt to the needs of the environment, to be a beautiful example of what it means to be restorative in community, right? Like you just being who you are so impactful because you're showing up in the fullness of what you believe and you're making beautiful music. Like that was to me the connection. And I feel like that's the power of circle practices, that we can do that for each other. We can remind each other of what it is we bring to the table. And I don't know that there's a lot of spaces where that happens.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. What a beautiful story and message. And just like, I think that resonates for everyone to think about finding a way to imagine what that looks like in your own context. And so much so, I was like totally in that stream of thought and then lost the next question. It was something around, because I had a follow-up thinking about that. And I am curious. Okay, so I'm just going to sort of also restoratively ramble. I was thinking about two things, and they might end in a question. We'll see. So one is, I keep coming back to this thought after you mentioned sort of like, I just hadn't thought about it in this kind of context about the ways that the criminal legal system, our systems of education, so many systems, period, are a reflection of a particular culture. And how, you know, if the purpose, if the hope, if the goals of cultural competency are to allow wholeness of a person to exist in a particular context and space, there are certain systems, and the criminal legal system is one of them, that is just absolutely designed at the opposite end of that spectrum and so fragmented and so much about isolation and sort of detaching an individual from other aspects of their whole identity into, you know, a particular moment of their life or a particular context or a particular thing. And so how to just hold that reality and thinking about what cultural competency looks like, if the goal of that is creating this sense of invitation to wholeness within a system that is so heavily around disconnection and separation and isolating, you know, people into these fragmented pieces. Yeah, I'm just curious, one, if you have any thoughts, and two, oh, that was the other thing. I was just, this doesn't come up in every conversation, but it seems like you actually do remember a lot of the conversations that came out of this session. And so, so if there are any other things that maybe come to mind around that, like around those tensions of how to do this with a good intention of this work within a really oppressive system whose cultural values are really around pretty polar opposite kind of values and intentions of what cultural competency is looking for. So yeah, just curious your thoughts on how to hold that tension in this work, and if any kind of examples of that stood out to you that came up in the session.
Hold the tension. I think that's your answer. I don't have great insight. You know, I grew up in a family where I was a middle child in my family of origin, and I always felt the need to fix the problem. I don't know where that comes from, but I thought, you know, if you can identify the problem and you come up with an intervention, you can fix it. And the older I've gotten and the more I've had real life experiences, I realize that's really not the equation at all. And to me, the thought of fixing systems is so overwhelming. I get extremely distressed and I want to give up. And I don't want to do anything at all in the face of such and what presents as such an insurmountable problem. But what gets me really excited is the interpersonal work. That I feel we can still do. I don't know how to fix the big systems, but I do know how we can approach each other one-to-one or in small groups or in medium-sized groups and really do things differently, because that's where we have control, right? You think about the spheres of influence, and you think about in every interaction I have with someone else, I get to decide. I get to decide how I show up, how I present, how I'm going to view and treat them, and really what I hope to leave them with at the end of our interaction, right? And so that actually does connect to something we talked about in my session, which is this idea of, this is gonna sound random, but we're rambling, so that's okay. But it's this idea of humble narcissism. I don't know if you've heard about it, but the psychologist Adam Grant wrote an article that I came across once. And it's really fascinating because a lot of people have like negative connotations when they think of narcissists, right? That they're all into themselves and they think that they're these perfect superior humans. But they have a really great quality, which is a lot of self-confidence and a lot of belief in who they are and what they have to offer. And so the idea in this article is if you balance that with humility, right? Not someone who is so humble that they're just going to like lay down and let people like stomp all over them, but this sense of real authentic humility paired with this really beautiful concept of self-awareness and self-confidence is really, and in this article, it was focused on leadership, like that makes just the best leader, right? Because now you have someone who really knows what they have to offer, but they also know what their weaknesses are and what their limitations are, and they're more than happy to learn from their mistakes. And so in our group, we envisioned what the world would be like if we all could step in and embody more of that combination, right? Of seeing each other for these incredible human beings that we are, and full joy and creativity and complexity, but also as flawed humans that really need each other. And I like to think that that's the answer. That if we could really figure out how to expand, right? If we start with these really small interpersonal interactions and we get into circles and then we make the circles bigger and bigger. And I just see this ripple effect. Maybe there's a possibility we can eventually change systems that way. I hope.
That is a beautiful vision of the world that could and maybe should be. So I appreciate you for offering that vision. And I don't want to come right around to like dampen that vision, but something that I was interested in asking you, like doing my Googles and looking a little bit into your work. Folks who have listened to other episodes in this series have heard me talk about like the fact that where I'm at in Texas and in other places throughout the United States, we are in a time where like diversity, equity, inclusion, and other things closely connected to cultural competence or cultural humility are being legislated out. I keep giving the example of the fact that thanks to Texas Senate Bill 17, the LGBTQ Resource Center and Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Center at my alma mater that I volunteered at are closed permanently. So again, not to dampen, but maybe like, again, applying this vision of how we can start small and then grow, how do we push for and advocate for restorative justice, which is often associated in some people's minds with diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives for good reason? And how especially can we push for an RJ that is culturally humble and is not color, gender, or class avoidant?
I really appreciate what you said about recognizing where we are in this moment. And it's painful, right? There are really not a lot of great things to be said about what's happening right now. I think that there are things that bring me some amount of comfort and resolve and determination. And one of those things is remembering that this is not new, right? Like, this is our lifetime. And so it obviously feels really big to us, but this has sort of been how it's been throughout history in many ways. And so experiencing it again, not to put a spin on it, but it does provide an opportunity. It provides an opportunity to really demonstrate our commitment. Because I think when things are maybe going a little bit more your way, it's a lot easier to coast and to just stand on the sidelines and to just think that things will work out without your involvement. And then when things get really challenging, you realize, no, it really does take all of us. And we're reminded of that. And so I think it's time to have a renewed sense of commitment in the world that we want to live in. And there are so many things about this world right now that don't reflect that, at least for me. I can speak for myself. And I really appreciate what Alana said earlier about the dominant culture, because I think this work, and I actually think RJ work at its core, is countercultural, and we might even say counter-dominant cultural, right? Like, that's really what makes it so powerful and so necessary. And so that's my biggest, you know, that I don't know what to call it, but that to me, I think is a very compelling reason. If we have to get into how to justify why this work is so important, and sometimes I'm really reluctant to do that, but I know that it's necessary at the same time, is really, it's an investment in the world we want to live in. And as in all of my years of professional experience, I haven't found anything else that works quite as well. Right. And so if we really want something that's going to create the results we want to see, then I think we need to invest in it before that's apparent. And that also is countercultural, right? So we're asking people to really engage in something that feels very uncomfortable in so many ways. And then we're saying, that's okay, sit with the discomfort, right? Which is also something that's uncomfortable. And so I think that, to me, that's what makes it so authentic and so real, is that it isn't easy, and that it pushes all of our buttons and it challenges us in the best of ways. And to me, that's how you know you're doing real work. I'd like to share a quote with you that I really enjoy, but in my session, we wrestled with this, because I think one of the things about the dominant culture, and that a lot of us experience in our workplaces and in other spaces, is this need to have the answer, right? Remember when I said, like, there's a big problem and we have to figure out how to solve it. And this is a quote I shared with my group. See, my glasses aren't really working right now, but it's by Rainer Maria Rilke. I don't know if I'm saying that properly.
I'm an English major. It's Rilke.
How do you say that? Rilke. Thank you so much. Trying my best here. But anyway, it's from a book called Letters to a Young Poet. And I'm going to read this quote to you because I absolutely love it. It says, "I would like to beg you to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers, which could not be given you now, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer." And that's what I left my group with, right? Is can we do that? Can we be courageous enough to just live with the questions? And I feel like that's what RJ invites us to do. And that's what we do time and time and time again. And I have found that to be the best way to engage in this work in the world. And I hope others can experience that as well.
Wow. I tried to scribble some of that. I'm going to have to look up that quote again later because it was so beautiful. And just so many both ands, even just listening to that, because you're totally right that it definitely evokes a sort of like, but you want an answer. We have to have answers. Answers are good. But the flip of that, of like how untamed in a beautiful way, just living with the questions can be, and how important that is to see what comes when you live into those answers. So that is actually maybe the best way to segue into what we usually end with, which is a sort of a magic wand question, how to change the world in this one answer. And to flip it, rather than an answer, I am curious if the magic wand that we are bestowing to you in this moment is a magic wand that can plant the seed of a question. And I love that visual of in that quote of thinking about the question as a room full of books that you're sitting in. And the goal is not to find the answer, but to arrive at the point where you're living to understand the answer. What would your question be?
And this is a question that I would...
A question sort of under the umbrella of cultural humility, that if the magic wand could sort of have everyone in the world spend time in their own rooms full of books and have to really spend time living with this question, what would the question be?
Yes, now I know the answer, which is not what I'm supposed to have, but... The question I would pose, and I love when you said, you know, you're sitting in a room with books, it made it so clear to me that this is the question you first ask of yourself, and then we ask of each other. And it is this: what is it that you need to be whole? Because I truly believe if we are asking ourselves that, we will have a much clearer sense of what it is we need in order to go into the world and not harm other people, right? In order to go into the world and to seek the best in others and to seek to help everybody reach a level of peace and contentment and joy. And I'm just envisioning people laughing together, right? Like, what is it that we need to get there? And if we know that for ourselves, we'll be free to ask that unencumbered of others, and the others will be able to reciprocate that. Because when someone asks you that and they really want to know the answer, that is an incredible point of connection. Wow, you care? You really care that much? You really care about who I am and what it is that I need to be whole? Oh my goodness. Like, imagine how that would change the world.
I think you're right. I think that might be the question at the core of all of this, or at least it's emerging for me as one of the core questions. I want to thank you so much for giving us your time, your energy, your wisdom. I just want to leave you with the last word. How can folks support you, your work, connect to you, or just anything else that you want to leave us with?
Thank you so much. I mean, I think the way that you can support this work, not just for me, but for everyone, is take the time, spend some time with yourself, get to know yourself a little bit better. Let's do that work of self-awareness and self-reflection, because we have to carve the time for it ourselves. Nobody is going to create that space for you, right? And so if you can be committed to that, if you can be committed to doing the work on you, that to me is paramount. Because what often happens is people are like, well, what can I do? What action can I take? And they go out into the world and they're not ready. They're just not ready to take any kind of substantive action because they haven't really investigated who it is they are first. So that to me is one way you can support this work. In terms of finding me and finding out what I'm up to, I do have a website. It's called grounded-intention.com. And so you can find me there.
Beautiful. We'll put that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Ish, for joining us. Alana, thank you. Anything you want to share before we close out?
Just gratitude, so many thoughts and great insights and stories, and as always, just so good to see and share space with you.
Thank you both. This has been great.
Thank you.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.